Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today are Professors Brent Nelson and James Guth from Furman University, where they're both political science professors. And they have co-authored a very interesting book, Religion and the Struggle for European Union. And like all good academics, it has a subtitle, Confessional Culture and the Limits of Integration. And we'll get into that. But first of all, gentlemen, welcome to the journal.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
In interest of full disclosure, I must note that Dr. Nelson is also chair of the ETV Commission. But that's not why we had him on the show. If this were television, you would look at my book, which has got all sorts of reminders and notes and what have you, because after I read it, I went digging on the internet for all sorts of things, because it is, when I say it's a challenging book, not a challenging book to read, but it really gets someone, but particularly a historian, going back to the Middle Ages and thinking about things. So anyway, Brent, let's put out there kind of briefly what the book is all about. What do you mean about confessional culture? Mm-hmm. Where does all that fit in?
Well, that's a really good question, because many people, especially Europeans, will say, why are you talking about religion and Europe? There's very little religion in Europe. And we want to argue that, in fact, religion has a powerful effect on Europeans, but it may not be the kind of effect that you see overtly. Like, people don't go to church as much in Europe as they used to or as they do in America. But religion has shaped European culture in deep and lasting ways. And our argument is that you really need to go back to the Reformation itself to understand how divided Europe is, especially over the nature of European integration or bringing countries together. And Catholics look at things and are shaped by different forces than are Protestants. And so the real divide in Europe is this divide between Catholic confessional culture and how people's attitudes are shaped by that, and Protestant confessional culture, and how people's attitudes towards Europe are shaped by that culture.
All right. And Jim, why don't you define for us what Catholic confessional culture is in this context?
Well, Catholic confessional culture, in our terms, is much more concerned with the nature of polities. Catholics have always been less comfortable with the nation state. They've always seen some sort of transnational formation as being more in tune with the nature of ultimate reality. Protestants coming out of the Reformation have associated Protestant liberties, indeed the survival of Protestantism itself, with strong nation states in Northern Europe. And as a result, they've always been much more skeptical about the prospects for European unity in any real political sense. And they have a very different vision of how states ought to cooperate with each other. And those things emerge out of the nature of the institutions and out of the nature of institutional or church relations with nation states.
Jim, when you were talking about the Catholic confessional view, you're obviously going back to things like the Holy Roman Empire, the fact when there was one Christian denomination.
Now, sure. Christendom.
There was Christendom. Well, you've had East and West Christendom, but I mean, in Europe you had one.
Well, we're looking, of course, primarily at the history of the European Union at Western Christendom.
Yes.
More recently, of course, we have the issue of expansion to Eastern Christendom, and that brings in an added level of religious complexity to the relations within the European Union. But certainly in Catholic confessional culture, there's always been the memory of union, whether it's Charlemagne's empire or the Holy Roman Empire. There's always this notion that somewhere above lower level political entities, there's this unity of Christendom, unity of the Christian faith that ought to have political expression. And even though sometimes that's taken a back seat to the purposes of national states as they emerged in early modern period, in Catholic culture, and it's exhibited by the papacy itself and by the nature of the International Catholic Church, there's always that notion there's something above the nation state. And indeed, ideally, that is the superior form of organization, if only we could achieve it.
And when you're referring to the Protestants in Europe, and actually you get into the debate, is the United Kingdom, is Britain really part of Europe or not? They they haven't decided themselves. But, of course, that is a Protestant nation with an official established Protestant church. Mm. So all the Scandinavian countries, have official established churches. The Netherlands did for a while.
There are different experiences. Now the Scandinavians are quickly disestablishing their churches. Mm-hmm. But yes, for centuries they've had established Lutheran churches. In the Netherlands, it worked a little differently because the Reformed Church was never the dominant church like it was in Scandinavia. Yeah.
What I was getting at is the churches were associated with the nation state.
Correct.
As opposed to the Holy Roman Empire. With the Reformation and Luther, the Holy Roman Empire began to disintegrate. I mean, it was still there when Napoleon was there, but it was, you know.
And there were other kinds of elements involved here. Obviously, the Counter-Reformation and the effort of the Catholic Church to retake, sometimes successfully, areas that had been infiltrated or taken over by Protestantism created an atmosphere, not only the actual wars, but much of Protestant culture, of course, was couched in anti-Catholic attitudes for a long time. If you go back and read the history of all the northern countries, you find in different ways that the Catholic Church became the other. And indeed, those kinds of attitudes have persisted for a long time, long after religious observance has declined in many Protestant countries.
That's just been a part of that whole outer, I don't want to say outer ring, but that's the northern tier.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair term?
Yes. And we do have to recognize that nationalism and the nation state, it was important to Catholic areas as well. This little thing called the French Revolution created difficulties for the Catholic Church in Catholic areas. So you did have a development of the nation state in both Protestant and in Catholic areas. But in Catholic areas, the development of the nation state was antagonistic towards the church. The liberal state was anti-clerical. And so the Catholic Church always had this notion that Europe was still one single cultural whole that should have some political expression. And the spiritual expression was, of course, in the papacy itself, in the Pope himself. But there was always that nurtured remembrance of this time when Christendom was a single whole. So that lived on in Catholic areas, whereas in the Protestant areas, the nation state grew up in tandem with this state church. In fact, the state needed the church for legitimacy, and the church needed the state for protection. So in Protestant areas, like in Britain and in the Scandinavian North, those nation states grew up as kind of political religious nation states. In continental Europe, where the Catholics maintained dominance mostly, it grew up differently. It was really this antagonistic relationship, but with the Catholics always maintaining this notion that there should be a single entity.
Something broader than the nation state.
Sure. And the papacy itself is a good example of a supranational government. Now, it's not political in the sense after Christendom dissolved, it wasn't political anymore. But the papacy is transnational. It has law. It collects financing. It has a treasury. It has a cultural impact. So in lots of ways, the Catholic papacy is a kind of image of this transnational organization, supranational organization that the European Union has reflected.
Let's fast forward to the 20th century and the beginnings of the idea of a European Union. People say, well, that came after World War II. No, that's not true.
Well, no, the idea of a European Union or a European unity goes way back. Well, we could really say it goes back to Augustus in the Roman Empire, but it has lived on intellectually in many circles, and you can go back to the Middle Ages. Dante himself wrote a book about the monarchy that would be trans-European and would be focused on the emperor. But all the way through history, there's been this constant a nurturing of this idea of Europe as a single entity. In the interwar period between World War I and World War II, this became quite fashionable in lots of intellectual circles. There's this guy, Count Richard Coudenhove-Kalergi, who developed an organization called Pan-Europa. And even Winston Churchill joined this organization. But many of the European leaders, both present in the interwar period and post-war, were taken up with this notion of European unity. it didn't get very far in terms of real politics, but that idea carried through World War II and began to flourish in the post-war period as leaders who had been influenced by these thoughts, particularly Christian Democrats, came to power with the notion that maybe Europe should be more united.
The fragmentation of Europe after World War I, the many nation states, of course, the pan-Europeans would argue this is what caused World War II, and that's an oversimplification. But the folks who were gathering that you're talking about, the pan-Europeans, they were meeting in Switzerland, isn't that correct, before?
After the war, they met in Geneva, and there was mostly in Geneva.
After the war, yes, you talked about the Christian Democrats. I think we ought to define that for folks, because as parties, they're not nearly as visible on the national news now as they once were. But certainly in the major European countries after World War II, Italy, Germany, Austria, others, the Christian Democrats become a force. And so let's talk about their role.
Well, the Christian Democrats, of course, are a party of Christian inspiration, primarily Catholic, although in Germany, one of the successes of the Christian Democratic Party, which replaced the old Center Catholic Party, was that they were open to Protestants and indeed attracted a fairly large number of Protestant supporters as well. But the kind of importance of, in some ways, of the Christian Democrats was that they did have these international connections during the period between the war. Some of the leaders that emerged after the war had been in contact with each other in Christian Democratic or Catholic circles, thinking about the ideas of European Union. Of course, in a lot of ways, the trauma of the war and the problems of reconciling, especially France and Germany after the war, the problems of economic reconstruction, you had a whole set of problems for which European Union seemed to be a kind of reasonable answer. And these people had been thinking about this for a long time already, and as we point out in the book, emerged into positions of power after the war so they could really do something about it, and had substantial political parties based primarily in Catholic electorates, which were dominant in many European countries, especially in the countries that became the six that signed the treaties of Rome.
You mentioned the problems of reconciliation with Germany. That was the German problem. And, of course, you have to reconcile the Germans with the French. But you've also got the rise of, the Iron Curtain, the whole question of the Cold War. And the United States plays a role in this to an extent, do they not?
Well, yes. The United States, many of the leaders were influenced by Jean Monnet, who was a French civil servant that went back and forth across the Atlantic many times during the war. He was a very important integrationist, thought deeply about European unity. And so the Americans were generally in favor of some kind of European integration effort. But the Americans were never very clear on exactly what that looked like. They left it to the Europeans to develop the details. It took a crisis, and it really was a crisis of German unity and German rearmament, that forced the French to think in new ways. In fact, the Americans told the French, told Robert Schuman, you have to come up with a plan. You have to settle this, and you have to do it very soon. And so that put the time pressure on the French. And as Jim has pointed out, many of these leaders, Robert Schuman, El Cid de Gasperi, Konrad Adenauer in Germany, they were all friends. They had met together in Switzerland. They had met together before the war. They were devout Catholics. They understood each other very well. And these ideas of integration bubbled up to the surface. These are revolutionary ideas in many ways. When you're talking about ending the importance of national borders and bringing people together, those are revolutionary ideas, and they don't just pop out of nowhere. They have to bubble up and they become possibilities. So that became a possibility. Jean Monnet developed a specific plan for uniting the coal and steel industries, and that was the plan that eventually went forward in 1949-1950 that the Americans accepted and pushed very hard for. The Germans, the French, the Italians, they were all in favor. It was the British that were left out, both deliberately and the British weren't all that interested anyway.
Yeah, that's one of the things I found fascinating. as you discussed the evolution of what now becomes the European Union, or today is the European Union, the role of Britain in or out, Churchill very early on made it clear, you know, Europe's over there, we're over here. And the iron and coal, I mean, people say, what's the big deal? Because this has to do with the German industrial area, the Ruhr, which had been the problem before World War I, the problem after World War I, because the French didn't like the idea the Germans might economically revive. But the Americans forced the issue. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, the French were concerned that if Germany revives economically, they will naturally revive militarily. And their concern was all the German guns would be pointed at them. Now, we did have the rise of the Soviet Union, and so that became an important element in the Cold War. The United States wanted a strong European ally with guns pointed to the east, and that definitely loomed large in their minds. A united Europe looked a lot stronger than a fragmented Europe. A united Germany looked like a much better buffer than a fragmented Germany. But the French were just petrified that once again a rearmed Germany would not be tied to the West, but would be neutral or tied to the East, and the guns would be pointed at them. And they had had three experiences of this going back to 1870. Mm-hmm. They were going to have to fight the Germans all over again. And so you can understand why the French would be very, very concerned about a new German state with a new German army. So they had to find a way to unite those two. And as you said, steel and coal were the foundational industries to make war. Well, if you unite those industries, if France and Germany have no national control over those industries, if they're controlled by a higher supranational organization, then maybe Germany can't make war anymore, because the French will know everything that's going on and will actually be able to help control those important industries. So that's why it became the key to peace on the European continent.
Where or how does NATO come into play into this picture?
Well, NATO was formed in 1949. They didn't invite Germany into NATO quite yet, but it became the defensive organization or the defense organization. But clearly, NATO was going to be very open to German rearmament. So France knew that that was going to be helpful, but they still distrusted. And as we know, the French always distrusted NATO. They pulled out militarily mm-hmm. in the 60s. So they weren't all that encouraged by the rise of the United States and the rise of the United States military. And so this was just another element in the unsettledness of the French consciousness and the political class at that time. They saw threats everywhere.
And let's just throw the Marshall Plan in while we're talking about American interference.
Well, yes, the Marshall Plan added a whole lot of money to the European continent. But what the Americans said is that you will get this money, but you have to figure out a way of dividing it up, and you have to divide that money up in a supranational way. That is, you have to agree amongst yourselves on how to divide that money. Now, many people in Europe thought that the Marshall Plan and the organization that came out of it, the OEEC, which became the OECD. Sorry. So the OEEC is the Organization for European Economic Cooperation, and the OECD is the Organization for Cooperation and Economic Development,
yep.
OECD.
Yep. That was part of the brilliance of Marshall's plan, right?
Right.
To let the Europeans do it, Jim?
Well, one of the things I think is important, and this kind of gets to the basic argument of our book, is that we're not seeing religion here as the only formative influence. One of the things that we want to stress is that other approaches to understanding European economic integration all have their contributions. And we have strategic concerns like we've been looking at here that come both from the other side of the Atlantic and European concerns as well. We also have concerns for economic development, economic theory that tells us that larger markets are going to be more productive than smaller markets, and erasing national economic boundaries are going to be positive. We see religion as one element, and a very important element, in the deliberations of decision makers. Quite often, confessional cultures are things that shape the way people think without them necessarily being conscious of their religious origins even. For example, the decisions by the Nordic countries and Britain to stay out. A lot of Labour Party politicians who were in power in the late 1940s, they thought of the Catholic Church as being archaic, being very conservative, traditionalist, anti-socialist, and of course the Labour Party was still socialist at that point, and they just had this antipathy toward the Catholic-dominated continent. And you can find the same sorts of expressions among Scandinavian politicians who saw even people as enlightened as Gunnar Myrdal talked about how benighted those continental Catholics were. And these were attitudes that weren't always expressed, but they one suspects they're at the back of a lot of political decision-makers' minds when they're looking at the options for economic formulations and for strategic arrangements, military arrangements, those sort of things are always important background factors.
When the British were involved in these efforts, like dividing up the Marshall Fund money, and when the Scandinavians were involved, they always pushed for national vetoes. They always pushed for the ability to make the decision as a nation state. Whereas the Continentals were much more comfortable with saying, well, we'll let an authority make these decisions for us. We'll grant power to this broader authority to make these decisions. And that's really where the disagreement occurred. So in the Council of Europe, which was an organization formulated in the late 1940s, some on the continent wanted the Council of Europe to become this supranational organization, but the British and the Scandinavians would not join unless there was a national veto for any decision made. The Council of Europe still exists, but it exists as a human rights organization that has no supranational power because the British and the Scandinavians won the day in the Council of Europe. So you can see how the different approaches have definitely affected the way the institutions developed.
That's a fascinating background for looking at the European Union today and where it may or may not go. So let's move forward. You mentioned that the Treaty of Rome, but there's sort of an archaic group. Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg formed something of a mini economic group.
Yeah, and I was in Brussels this fall, and I walked by their headquarters almost every day. It still exists. But Benelux, being Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, you know, all small countries, all low countries. They developed a monetary union, they developed a kind of economic union, and that became a kind of model for others. It wasn't quite the same, but yeah, and it still exists today in this little office in Brussels.
So the Treaty of Rome is the biggie, though. I think we need to move forward because mm-hmm. we really could discuss this thing for about three shows. But let's talk about the Treaty of Rome and the six. Jim?
Well, I think one of the things that's quite interesting is to look at the symbolism of the Treaties of Rome taking place in Rome, which by itself is a kind of symbolic reaffirmation of the effort to recreate European Union in a sense. And of course, those are the Treaties of Rome. There are several of them, are the basis for the creation of the Common Market, as it was then called, and the first step in the formalization of a larger economic unit. Coal and Steel Community, of course, and the European Atomic Commission, those sort of things were special purpose kinds of organizations. But this is a set of arrangements that's going to extend beyond those individual areas. And based on the experience, the successful experience of those earlier experiments as well.
So you've got those three low countries you've already mentioned, and you throw in Germany, France,
and Italy.
Yes. And if you think about those six countries, they were all dominated by Christian Democrats politically at the time. Now, in coalition governments for the most part, but the Christian Democrats provided mostly the prime ministers and the foreign ministers, and they were the ones that were negotiating this organization. And they started with economics because they felt like economics could lead, if you can cooperate well in economics, then it would lead step by step to greater political unity. So there was always a political idea and goal behind these efforts. And that's what drove the Protestant countries really away from the efforts. Britain knew that if they entered these negotiations, they would have to accept this political goal, and the Scandinavians as well. And so they provided, I mean, they sent some low-level civil servants to the negotiations leading up to the 1957-58 treaties of Rome, but they dropped out because they couldn't accept this supranational notion that they would lose a national veto eventually. So that's why they stayed out. Now, eventually they came in, and mostly because economically they were too lonely. They needed partners, and they realized, the British especially realized, that they weren't the great power that they used to be. They needed to join with the rest of the continent for the kind of peace and prosperity they were looking for, but they did so reluctantly.
Britain's staying out, they still thought that the empire and the Commonwealth was going to be their world.
Sure.
And that collapsed by the early 60s. That world had disappeared. Mm-hmm. Not that they had accepted it, but it had disappeared.
And they had missed the boat because the economic community was formed in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. So by the time they realized that the empire wasn't going to be their salvation in the post-war period, they now needed to join the European community, but it would be, they wouldn't be able to negotiate it. They would have to join them on their terms. And that was difficult for Britain to come to.
All right, gentlemen, we need to pause for a moment to let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professors Brent Nelson and James Guth about religion and the struggle for European Union. Now, the Nordics, to get back to the outsiders, mm-hmm. the Nordics tried to form a group as well, did they not? And we're talking now Norway, Sweden, Denmark primarily, Finland sort of. Mm-hmm.
And Iceland sort of.
And Iceland sort of.
Yes, they had formed a number of cooperative unions over time. And one of our arguments is that countries that are a lot alike culturally are easier to bring together in some kind of union. So the Scandinavian countries, they speak similar languages, they have very similar cultures. You would think that they would be able to do something like this politically. And they did in many ways. But as Protestants, they were still very enamored with their own borders. And so they didn't really form any kind of real tight union, but they did have some. They decided not to join, for the most part, except for Denmark. They decided not to join the European community in the early 1970s. Some of them were neutrals, like Sweden and Finland. So they didn't want to do it for foreign policy reasons. They all had a number of different reasons. But the most important thing to note is that they simply distrusted the supranational elements of the European community, and so they wanted to stay out.
So we've got, Jim, as you pointed out, the first of several treaties of Rome, the creation of the common market. And where does it go from there? Let's bring things up towards the present now.
Well, of course, we've had a series of treaties since that time, and generally the effort or the notion that dominated most of those treaties was increasing levels, ever closer union is the phrase that was the goal. And of course, the Protestant countries have been skeptical or even resistant to that notion, but generally additional treaties, Maastricht and other treaties since, have increased the power and authority of Brussels institutions. And let me mention one of the things in our book, which is near and dear to my heart, and that's the analysis of what people think about these increasing powers and increasing centralization in the European Union. One of the things that got us started on this project to begin with, and we, I think, mentioned it in the preface to the book, is a kind of empirical evaluation of European citizens and how they think about the European Union. And we discovered very early on that there was really quite a gap between Catholics and Protestants, that even within the original six, that Protestants were much less enthusiastic about the prospect of a supranational institution gaining real power in Europe. And this we could first see in 1973 when the first Eurobarometer, international surveys were done of European citizens. And we have followed this now for over 30 years and found very consistently this difference between Protestant citizens and Catholic citizens.
And the two countries of the six we mentioned that had significant Protestant populations were Germany and the Netherlands.
Netherlands. And even in those countries, in most years, even though the Protestants were accustomed to working with Catholics, especially in Germany, where they were devout Protestants, were often Christian Democrats as well, we find that Protestants, both at the what we call the mass level, the average citizen, and even among politicians, Protestants were less enthusiastic about more expansive visions of powers of the European Union. And we find that in Germany, for example, that the Protestant leaders in the Christian Democratic Party had a very different vision than their Catholic counterparts did. And we find the same thing in the Netherlands. And in the Netherlands, many of the more radical Protestants never liked the European Union, and they were opposed to it in some of the re-reform groups, extremely conservative Protestant groups. And we find that generally, even as the European Union expanded to Britain and Scandinavia, we still find that those people, and typically in the early years, the more devout the Protestant, the less they like the European Union. The more devout the Catholic, the more they like the European Union. And those were very consistent patterns for three decades at least.
And I know that Ian Paisley gets some attention in your book in Northern Ireland, because he was not very happy about the idea that the threat from the Pope. But there's one country that I thought that might be an anomaly, and that is the Scots, because they seem to be pro. I mean, they're not a particular religious people anymore. I think it's just barely 50% claim to be religious, but the overwhelming majority of those are members of the various versions of the Church of Scotland. Mm-hmm. And yet the Scottish population seems to be pro-European Union.
One of the things that's frustrating to us, and especially to me as somebody who does a lot of work on American religion and politics, is the very poor differentiation we have in European surveys on different religious groups. So when the Eurobarometer does surveys, and when other organizations do surveys of political activities in Europe, they don't do very well in finding out exactly where people are religiously. They kind of go Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, and that's about all you have. And so we're very interested in looking at the more extreme reform groups in the Netherlands, for example, or at free church people in Germany, or evangelical groups outside the state churches in Scandinavia, because we know from a lot of qualitative literature, these people and their organizations have not been very enthusiastic about the European Union. But when we're looking at church members in surveys, we can't distinguish them. Mm-hmm. And the Scots, sometimes some surveys I will actually distinguish among different religious groups in Great Britain. And we find that the Scotch Presbyterians are indeed a little more interested in the European Union and more favorable toward it than people in the Church of England, or especially Methodists and Baptists in Great Britain, but that they're probably a little less enthusiastic than secular Scots are. It's a very nuanced kind of picture that we get.
Well, and there's always the position, if the English don't want it, we're going to like it.
Yeah, I think that helps illustrate one of our big points, that religion is a strong but very deep explanatory factor. There are other things that can overwhelm it at individual times. So a relationship with England, or economic benefits that they might get. But Jim's right. At the deepest level, Scotland is less enthusiastic than would be Catholics on the continent. So in relative terms, they look more pro-European than their English counterparts, but maybe not as pro-European as their continental Catholic partners.
Let's start expanding the six and how that worked out or how it didn't work out. Who's the first new person that is rushed by the fraternity and comes in?
Right. Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. The British and a couple of the Scandinavian countries, Denmark and Norway in particular, did apply for membership early in the 60s, then later in the 60s. Both times they were vetoed by Charles de Gaulle, mm-hmm. president of France. And he vetoed them because he said, they're just not like us, which is, I think, a very interesting way of putting it, because the Brits would have said the same thing. You know, we're not like them, but we still want in because we see economic benefits. But Charles de Gaulle, who was not the most enthusiastic European, he liked Europe as long as France was leading it. But he sensed that Britain wasn't really a one of us. And the British made it clear that they too didn't think the French were one of them either. So there was this tension. After Charles de Gaulle left the scene, then Britain reapplied. Actually, they just left their application open. And in 1973, Britain, Ireland, and Denmark joined the European community. Norway was invited in, but they had this little referendum, and the Norwegian people said no. So they stayed out. So you had two new Protestant countries and one new Catholic country. Ireland became instantly a Euro-enthusiastic country because very Catholic. But Denmark and Britain were always the reluctant partners, always holding back. And eventually Denmark voted in a referendum against the Maastricht Treaty, and that was a very important treaty that eventually led to the euro. And by that time, there were more countries in. Spain and Portugal and Greece were in by that time.
France had actually tried to keep Spain and Portugal out.
Yes, they did. And that was market rivalry. But, you know, the French like to be in. They're not sure they like anybody else to be in. But so by 1991, the Berlin Wall was down. There was tremendous uncertainty about what Europe was after the end of the Soviet Union. So the European community came together in a little town in the Netherlands called Maastricht at the end of 1991, and they agreed to a treaty that had a major economic element. That was the creation of a single monetary policy, which led to the single currency called the euro. It had a political dimension as well, but not a very strong one. They were going to try to coordinate their foreign policies more deeply. But they didn't achieve a kind of political union that many of them wanted to, including Jacques Delors, the commission president at that time. Why? Because the British and the Danes would have vetoed it. They would never have allowed that to happen. And in fact, the Danes rejected the first treaty. Both Britain and Denmark got what we call opt-outs, which means we get to stay out of all the important parts of the Maastricht Treaty, including the euro and lots of important bits. But to stay in what they renamed the community, they renamed it the European Union at that time. They wanted to stay in, but they just didn't want to be part of a lot of these things. So you can see right there that there's this deep divide between the two Protestant countries and the other countries, which were primarily Catholic. So that's where we were at Maastricht, which was a very important moment in European Union history.
About this time, they're beginning to think in terms of symbolism. And Jim, that's what you've talked about, the flag.
Yeah, one of the things that we were very interested in is putting together, you know, some sort of understanding of the symbolism and the way it connected to religious history and so on. And in our book, we talk a lot about the different symbols, the European flag, a variety of other things which have some religious resonance. And Brent and I both, when we're abroad, we like to look for portraits of the Madonna with the stars and the blue background that look very much like the European flag. And we as Protestants, when we see that, those pictures of the Madonna, we think instantly European flag, you know, and for Catholics, certainly there's much more resonance there. We just finished a little article, which isn't in the book, but we look at the way in which people regard the European flag across the European Union today. And as we find in our other statistical analysis, Catholics are much more reverent toward the European flag than Protestants are. They like it a lot better. They identify with it more. And what's more interesting is they want it flown next to their national flag on all of their government buildings, all public buildings in their country. Protestants say, no, we don't want the European flag up there. And they don't identify with it either. And we find that, you know, very evocative in some ways, showing how at a very deep level, Protestants still don't identify with that supranational entity or its symbols. And I think if we had other symbols that they were asked about in surveys, we would find the same sort of thing. So these symbols are important, but they evoke different emotions from Protestants and Catholics and presumably from secular people as well.
All right. What about as the European Union has taken in former states that were part of the old Soviet Empire, for lack of a better term? How have those states reacted to this concept of Central Europe, the idea of increasing centralization? I mean, they were part of a system that was pretty centralized.
Yeah. Well, of course, that has really complicated matters, and it has created more lines of division within the European Union. And certainly from our perspective, looking at the role of religion, it's complicated things even more, as has the passage of time. Many of the new member states in the European Union, of course, have substantial Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox populations. They have Muslim populations. And in many of the new member states, the Catholic Church's orientation is rather different than it was in Western and Central Europe. So as you may have noticed, the Poles have elected a new government, Law and Justice, which is a very, very Catholic party, but it's a very traditionalist Catholic party. And many of the Eastern European Catholic churches not only have a stronger identification with the nation state because of their history than perhaps even some of the Western European countries do, but they also are more traditionalist in their orientation. They're not enthusiastic about the more liberal social policies of the European Union on things like gay marriage and abortion, these kinds of issues. And so traditionalist Catholics in these countries actually tend to be less supportive of the European Union. One thing that's taken place under Law and Justice in Poland is the European flag, getting back to the flag, has been removed from public buildings and public forums. Mm-hmm. Only the Polish flag now is present at government press conferences and things like that. And there have been demonstrations in which the European flag has been burned by Law and Justice supporters, which would not be characteristic of Catholic attitudes in Western Europe through much of our recent history.
And of course, recently, the Polish government has been criticized strongly by the European Union for their policies, which I'm not sure how politically to describe them, but they are not representative of democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the judicial system has been changed and press freedoms, at least in some people's minds, have been curtailed. I think this is important. Poland, of course, is a kind of special case, partly because religion was such an important element in the resistance against communism. Yeah. But the Polish Catholic Church has always seen itself a little bit differently than other Catholic churches across Europe. They saw themselves as the defender of the Western Gate between the East and the West. And they also saw themselves as a kind of Christ to the rest of Europe. They would sacrifice their lives to maintain Christendom or Christian Europe. And so they've had a kind of messianic attitude towards the rest of Europe. John Paul II was Pope when they came into the European Union. He was a very strong supporter of Polish entry to the European Union, but he thought, and he certainly said this many, many times, that he thought Poland would help Christianize the rest of the West. And it really didn't turn out that way. Poland went the other way. It sort of got westernized. Or as one priest put it, it got McDonaldized. And I don't know how you say that in Polish, but the sentiment is quite clear. And so that's what's turned a lot of the Polish Catholics, and I would say other East European Catholics, they're much more conservative socially, and they see the European Union as even forcing them to accept certain policies that they just don't think are morally justified. And so they like the idea of European Union. They just don't like this European Union. And so they have developed an antagonistic relationship to it.
Well, let's bring it up to the last 2 or 3 years, the problem of Greece, the whole idea of monetary policy and control, which I'm not quite sure that the European Union still has got its handle on that. But attitudes, I think, are important as a result of the Greek crisis.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, let me go a little more broadly to the entire economic crisis of the euro and of Greece. One of the things that we see in terms of our interest is that in recent years there's been a real reshuffling in some sense of religious attitudes toward the European Union. If we look at data from the 2009 European election study, we find very much our pattern that we've seen for 35 years in public opinion poll data, where Catholics are more supportive, Protestants less. Religious minorities tend to be more in favor of the European Union, in part because the European European Union has taken some steps to, you know, kind of protect ethno-religious minorities in member states. And so Muslims, for example, quite often look to the European Union as being friendlier to their interest than their particular country is. And so we see those patterns. After the economic crisis, we discover that the Orthodox, who had previously been very supportive of the European Union, especially in Greece, and Catholics, who predominate in the southern tier of European states, which really had the crisis, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and so on, that Catholics have become much less supportive of the European Union than they were. This shows that sometimes, at least at one level, economics overrides religious or confessional culture. Interestingly enough, to get inside baseball here with my political science cohort, once you control for everything else, the religious factors still point in the same direction that they used to. It's just that in the short run, those economic problems will tend to override the religious preferences or the religious tendencies of the different confessions. So the economic crisis has had a major effect on support for European unity across the Union. You see that in all the data that you really had in 2006, 2007, a kind of a high level of support in most countries, further unification, and that has dropped during the eras from 2009 to the present because of the economic turmoil in the European Union. And interestingly enough, the Protestant countries, which tend to have done better, are somewhat more supportive of European unity now than they had been previously. So we have the interaction of a variety of different factors here.
Well, there's a term that, and I don't remember which British politician used it, but referred to the lesser nations. Could have been Churchill, but I don't recall. I just remembered that. But and Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, talked about Protestant ethics, mm-hmm. the work ethic in the North as opposed to, you know, the Southern Europeans. Mm-hmm. It sounded like the immigration debate in the United States in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. You know, those Greeks and those Italians.
There's a lot of national stereotyping going on in Europe right now because the economic crisis has divided the continent north to south. But there's also a confessional culture element there. And, you know, which comes first? The Protestant areas tend to be the most prosperous right now, and the Catholic areas less so. And so there has been a kind of superiority complex among the Protestants. And Angela Merkel is the daughter of a Protestant minister. She grew up in East Germany, but she's from the Protestant wing of the Christian Democrats. And she looks very different than her mentor, Helmut Kohl, who was Chancellor of Germany in the Maastricht Treaty era. But he's a very devout Catholic. And they've taken quite different approaches. Angela Merkel being a lot tougher on the South and pushing austerity. And that has tended to divide Europe greatly. And it is interesting, it's divided along this confessional line. Now, with the current refugee crisis, that has opened up many different fissures as well. There was a kind of Protestant-Catholic divide there because the Protestant countries, with the exception of Britain, tended to be more open, like Sweden was accepting anybody. Mm-hmm. But now they're closing their borders, and so is Denmark, and so is Britain. And so you're seeing new fissures opening up. Again, we don't discount the influence of many different factors, but underneath it all, we see this deep division between the Catholic and Protestants.
And one of the things that, I mean, we're kind of interested in right now is looking at the kind of political reaction and the interaction with religious factors with the rise of the populist right-wing parties, which a lot of people are curious about in kind of religious terms, because many of them draw on images of restoring or protecting Christian Europe against these invasions by Muslim hordes, you know, the immigrants coming in from especially the Middle East. And yet we discover that when we look at the supporters of many of these right-wing parties, even though they use this kind of verbiage of, protecting Christian Europe, they tend to be the more secular elements in most of the societies where they appear. The National Front in France has been historically quite secular, and the nationalist parties, if we look at the European parliamentary studies, almost across the board, the right-wing populist parties tend to be pretty secular. Now, whether or not they are going to be attracting more religious people with their claims as the refugee crisis continues is an open question. They're certainly making an effort to do that. There's some evidence that the National Front has picked up some Catholic support. Historically, the Catholic Church in France has been very pro-Europe and has tended to work against any kind of nationalist right activity. But we see in the parliamentary elections the last time around, the European parliamentary elections, National Front drew more Catholic support than they'd had in the past. So the refugee crisis is also kind of reshuffling these religious alliances.
And the Danes and the Brits opt out, folks. In December of 2015, the Danes opted out of the justice and security vote in a referendum. And that, to me, is one of the most interesting points besides the religion, is that the elites in almost all these countries don't want to let the people have a say-so. Right. The Norwegians turned things down. The Danes turned, the Dutch have turned things down. Mm-hmm. It gets pretty dangerous. And, of course, we're not going to predict the future, but there will be a referendum in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. That's already been set. We don't know exactly when, but it will be within the next year or two. Mm-hmm. So this whole question of European Union is coming up again, but we're looking exactly at what you both have posited here, and that is a Protestant country, predominantly England, deciding what it's going to do. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Brent Nelson and James Guth, I want to thank you today for being with us on Walter Edgar's Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. The title may be somewhat academic, but the content is very informative. The evolution and development of what we now know as the European Union is a fascinating story, and it is well told in the book, Religion and the Struggle for European Union. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of the Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.